You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
You're listening to The Archaeology Show. TAS goes behind the headlines to bring you the real stories about archaeology and the history around us. Welcome to the podcast.
Hello and welcome to The Archaeology Show, episode 303.
On today's show, we talk about ancient hunting tools in Texas, a mysterious Peruvian gate, and carved mammoth ivory from Ukraine.
Let's dig a little deeper and finish that gate because I want to travel the universe. Welcome to the show, everyone.
Hello.
All right. Well, here's our travel update for this episode. We're in the great Pacific Northwest.
Yep.
As you're listening to this.
Probably one of our favorite places. We definitely come here every year anyway.
I have a goal this year.
Oh, you do?
And North Carolina notwithstanding, I hope to not ever be in weather or temperatures more than 75 degrees Fahrenheit.
I can mostly get on board with that goal as long as I get like some beach time somewhere.
Well, you'll get a beach.
But it'll have to be 75 degrees.
You might get a beach tomorrow.
Oh, these beaches don't count. I need an East Coast beach. I'm sorry. West Coast beaches, I love you. I do, truly. You're beautiful. You're wild. You are rugged. And you are cold.
I dare you to say something about British Columbia beaches. So we are on the Oregon coast right now.
Yes.
Visiting family.
Yeah, I should say, I know that there are warm beaches on the West Coast. They're just way far south of where we're at right now.
Yeah.
Anyway, go on.
Anyway, so we're on the Oregon coast right now visiting family. Yes. We're going to be heading up to Washington State for a few weeks and then off to Alaska. And in between Alaska and here, I think is something, I don't know, Canada? I don't know. What do they call it up there?
It's something like north of us, kind of big.
No, seriously, though. We've got so much planned.
We do.
We're going to see lots of things, talk about lots of things. It's going to be an APN extravaganza.
Yeah.
Lots of stuff.
Yeah. For the first time, we're doing travel planning, but also looking ahead at what types of really interesting archaeological sites or places or historical places even that we might be interested in stopping at. So I'm kind of interested to see how this goes, like from a travel planning perspective, because we also have to like get from point A to point B too. So
I mean, a lot of times our travel planning is based around places that the RV kind of needs to go or that we need to go for various reasons. But our travel planning for the summer was, we are going to Alaska, .. That's it.
Yeah.
But what do we do there? How do we get there? What are we doing? Well, that travel planning is, well, we're able to be flexible.
Yeah.
And we're being flexible around, you know, not just content creation, but content creation for the podcast and things we want to do and see, which we're interested in anyway.
Exactly. I was just going to say that. Yeah. Like, we love doing that kind of stuff when we're traveling. So, like, sometimes we just happen upon things, but this time we're putting a little bit more thought into it, I guess you could say, or research into it.
So like, for example, when we are travel planning, we try to go around Texas because, you know, Texans can be crazy and we don't want to get shot. But old Texans, 6,500 years ago, they were super cool and they had hunting kits, much like the ones do today.
Oh, my God.
But
I think you just alienated like 20% of our listeners. Good job.
20% of our listeners are not in Texas.
I mean, Texas is huge. I'm just saying. Yes. But this first story is from Texas and it is really, really cool.
Yeah. So this was actually reported in the New York Times and a few other places. But one of the links that the link that we're sharing is the Texas Parks and Recreation Department, I believe. Actually sharing the New York Times article.
It says Center for Big Bend Studies.
Oh, yeah, that's right. CBBS. That's right.
So Big Bend is a national park in Texas. Yeah. So I'm assuming that this is found somewhere close-ish to Big Bend.
Yeah, they kind of just like reprinted the New York Times article. And I wanted to give the Center for Big Bend Studies some link love. So,
I see. It's a great article, though. Yeah. And we had looked at some of the other articles because this was kind of big news. This is maybe a couple weeks since this article came out. We just sort of, we saw it come out. We didn't have time to talk about it on a show soon. So we sort of tucked it away into a list of things that we definitely wanted to talk about. And not all of the articles have really good photos in them. So the one that we're linking to has excellent photos.
Yeah, it does.
Though you'll need to look at them on a bigger form factor than your cell phone. Because when I first looked at this article on my cell phone, it chopped the picture weirdly or cropped it weirdly. Yeah. So make sure you're looking on at it on a larger screen, but definitely do go look because these artifacts are amazing.
Yeah. All right. So what is it?
Yeah.
All right. So we're looking at West Texas here. And we are talking about, again, this hunting kit. Mm-hmm. And the hunting kit itself dates back to about 1,500 years ago in what they call the Trans-Pecos region of West Texas.
Mm. Yeah. And what they found is a collection of meticulously crafted hunting tools all found together, which is, as you can imagine, super rare because you don't normally get a cache of tools like this together. Now, that's not entirely true, though. You can talk about the cache that you found one time. Yeah. We have, and we probably have talked about this on the show before, but like you do find hunting and tool caches sometimes, but this one just seems a little bit more special.
People always ask you as an archaeologist, what's the coolest thing you found? I always forget about that cache.
Yeah, that is the cool. That's the coolest that thing probably... I have watched somebody find. Yeah. Okay, now you have to tell the story. Go.
Okay.
You've got 2 minutes to tell the story because I know we told it on the show before.
All right. It's been a long time, though, probably. Yeah, I don't probably know if I've even told it on this show.
Maybe.
Okay, so burying the lead here. So yes. it was a dark and stormy day. No,
it probably wasn't. It was in North Carolina.
Yeah,
so.
It was a warm and humid, ridiculous day off the Cape Fear River in North Carolina.
Yes.
And we were doing phase three excavations, which basically means block excavations. And imagine a typical archaeological dig in the woods where you've got all these squares.
Big squares
and
open.
So we're digging in sand, and in sand you have to dig really slowly and really thinly with your shovel because chunk it out.
It's so easy to dig. There's nothing stopping you from just like ka-chunk, right?
Yeah.
So you have to be careful.
So you're digging with flat, basically imagine like a snow shovel, but like a flat shovel, right? Mm-hmm. Not like a wide snow shovel, just like a square shovel.
Yeah.
Because you want to dig flat floors, right?
Yeah.
So I'm just kind of like... scooting across in
along.
A few millimeters at a time because we go in 10 centimeter levels, but I'm going a few millimeters at a time. Think about maybe a quarter of an inch, eighth of an inch, give or take.
We're probably really looking for features because we were expecting to find like hearth feature type of things in this soil.
Yeah.
Artifacts too, but features specifically.
And there's not a lot of rocks and down this deep, there's not a lot of roots or anything. We're below all that.
Right, right.
Yeah, so it's just sand.
Yeah.
So then I hear this tink,
tink.
Yeah.
And I don't even know if I was there for it, but I've heard you tell the story. And the tink is my favorite part.
And I was like, the minute you hear the tink, you're like, okay, well, that could be something. And then you just go up there and you just kind of, wipe it away. And then you're just like, there's nothing there.
Yeah.
And then you just kind of, you do it again. It's like, tink. Tink. And it's like, okay, now I got another
trowel.
Tink.
You break the trowels out at that point.
Right. Then you get the trowel. But even with the trowel, I quickly was like, tink, 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 tink. And it's like, what's going on here?
What is happening?
So I eventually, and somebody else was digging near me, and eventually two of us were there. And we just, what you start doing with this kind of a thing is you start to dig around it. You start to pedestal it.
Yeah.
And you put it on this pedestal so you can start to dig around it and start to find it.
You get the edges of it.
Right.
Defined.
Once you get the edges defined and you start to dig down around it. You don't want to dig too far because again, the sand will dry out and it'll fall over and collapse.
Yeah.
So at some point you have to start digging the thing, but that's when you actually do get the brushes out.
Yeah.
You get brushes out and you get these fine, fine tools out. We actually use like chopsticks and things that have been, chopsticks are actually really good because you can shape them into little,
they're soft. Yeah.
They won't scratch anything and you can shape them. Actually, you can whittle them and shape them.
Yeah.
But anyway, so we started digging these things, but this was actually what we call a stone tool kit. And imagine thin rocks about the size of palm of your hand that don't really have any defined shape to them. Some of them were kind of leaf shaped and some of them were kind of roundish.
They had like pre-tool shaping to them.
Yeah. Kind of. We kind of have some people will define about five stages of a biface, and a biface is just a tool that has working on both sides.
Yeah.
So if you imagine like a projectile point or an arrowhead, that's basically a biface without any defined name to it. But imagine a tool kit like we found here. In Texas, this is a pre-tool kit, so they could have made anything they wanted. Mm-hmm. So you imagine these things had almost a shape to it, but not a definite shape to it.
Right. The one in your kit. In your cache that you found.
Yeah. And there was probably, I don't know, 10 of them.
Ten or so. And they were all like lined up in the same direction.
Right.
Which is, I mean, we were all just drawing assumptions on this, but it made us think that it was like they were in a pouch or a box or something that held them together. And whatever was holding them together had disintegrated away,
And but either it was buried or dropped.
It buried or dropped. Yeah, yeah. Probably buried, right? Like, because.
Well, I don't know. This was a surface at some point.
It was. But so, if you drop it, like, and then the thing disintegrates naturally, it sort of like is a little bit more diffuse.
Well,
whereas these were packed together and lined up next to each other.
Well, the thing could have disintegrated, but it also would have could have taken 100 years to disintegrate.
Oh, yeah. That's
so
true.
It could
yeah.
have had leaf have litter had, and soil yeah, built yeah. up around it because yeah. a hurricane could have happened the next yeah. year and covered it in sand.
Yeah.
You know, so anyway, that yeah. is the coolest thing.
That yeah. is the coolest thing. And all that's to say is that that's the coolest thing you've ever found in your archaeology career, right?
Yeah.
These caches, you don't come along them very often.
Not like that.
And not like that. And not like this either, the one in this article. So
now this toolkit was very different.
Very, very different. Yeah. It was, I mean, they have organic material in this kit, which is totally different from what you, yes. you found.
But they also had projectile points.
They did. Yeah. Yes. They had both.
So they
yeah.
had atlatl darts, and an atlatl is kind of it's a spear point. Well, it's kind of a spear, but it's more of a dart. It's a shorter thing. Well, it's a long thing, but it's hard to explain if you don't know what an atlatl looks like. Look it up. It's A-T-L-A-T-L.
Yeah, you have like a paddle, basically. A more paddle-shaped yeah. one, and then you have a longer, skinny piece that is on the end of it, and then you use it for chucking things really far.
Yeah, basically. The paddle is basically used like a lever.
Yeah.
Like a almost like a cantilevered sort of thing to give it thrust.
Kind of like when you're throwing a ball for a dog in one of those long things where you
yeah.
pick it up from the ground
yeah.
with the handle.
You pick up the tennis ball with the handle.
Yeah.
Imagine instead of a tennis ball, you've got a spear
dart.
Point in the end of it, a dart,
yeah.
and you're chucking the dart.
Yeah.
And on the end of the dart is a obsidian or chert
exactly.
point,
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
So you've got those. You've got these spurs, which are hook-like attachments for the atlatl that kind of cradled the dart.
Yeah.
Those are atlatl spurs. You've mm-hmm. got projectile points, a variety of stone points, which included minerals like chert and obsidian.
Mm-hmm.
So these were prepared for different types of game or situations.
Mm-hmm. And then you also had cordage, which is fragments of well-preserved plant fiber cordage, which was likely used for attaching the points.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, you've got the stone point and then it has to be attached to these wood or organic material shafts in some way. And so the cordage would yeah. have done that. And then leather fragments as well, which is, again, remnants of a pouch maybe or a wrapping that held the kit together, you know, another like functional right. piece of something of the, not the kit itself, but the things holding it together.
Yeah. The cool thing here is, I mean, the reason we have some of the cordage and the leather and things like that and the darts and stuff like that is because of the preservation.
Yeah. It's a cave, right?
It's a rock shelter cave like thing. You
yeah.
can kind of see the entrance
yep.
and it's also arid climate of West Texas.
Yeah.
There's not
all
a lot of
working together.
Yeah. There's not a lot of moisture. It's just, it's really dry.
Yep.
And it's just really helped to keep these things preserved.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The other thing that they found too was coprolite. So
yeah.
they have human waste at this site as well as all of these bits of a hunting toolkit. So mm-hmm. they know somebody spent some time here basically.
Yeah. Yeah. So we mentioned obsidian as being part of one of the stone tool points.
Mm-hmm.
The nice thing about obsidian is you can source obsidian.
Yes.
And when you look at the chemical makeup of the obsidian, it's like a fingerprint when it comes out yeah. of the volcanoes or the lava flows. Yeah.
Yeah. We talked about this a couple
right.
episodes ago. Yeah.
Yeah. Obsidian isn't locally sourced in this part of West Texas, which is kind of cool.
Yeah.
Which indicates that they must have either traveled to get it or traded to get it
mm-hmm.
or something like that. Either way, we know that this indicates some sort of broader network of people that were working
right.
together, you
yeah.
know, or they, you know, killed somebody and took it.
I mean, oh, well, that too, but that's still interaction with people.
It's still
along
interaction.
A broad space. So like,
yeah.
you know, however they got their hands on it. But
I mean, we know people were interacting with other people and obsidian
yeah.
trading actually is a really good way to know that or, you know, travel or something like that.
Yeah.
It's just, we know that people were interacting with others and it's really kind of cool to see this sort of obsidian network. It's kind of the way they use beads over in California and
mm-hmm.
places adjacent to California, like
mm-hmm.
the Eastern Mojave, Arizona, even.
Yep.
You can see these bead trading networks all over the place because people on the coast would basically harvest these beads and they would get traded out
right.
thousands of miles almost.
Yeah, totally. The other thing I thought was really interesting about this kit is the way that it was described by either one of the people who found it or somebody who has since worked on it. But it was a kit that it wasn't like, so what you found in North Carolina was a cache of ready to go tools,
mm-hmm.
tools that were ready to be formed into something.
Mm-hmm.
This was almost like the discard. like the discard of the kit. Like somebody was working through these various different tools and we're like, okay, this one is old, it's broken, this one needs to be fixed here, this one is, you know, and like was leaving behind the things that were no longer useful in the kit and or were worn out or something like that, or needed to be fixed, or maybe the broken pieces from after fixing. So it's kind of like, it's kind of like he was out hunting, or she, you know, you never know, and decided to post up in this cave around a fire and do a little tool repair.
Yeah, it's pretty cool.
And like we talked about earlier, there was also atlatl components, which is just yet another like piece of information to add to this picture here about the different like hunting methods that they were using in this period, in this place. So that's also really awesome.
Yeah, because you can kind of date the use of the atlatl and the invention and well, and I guess use of it in different time periods.
Yeah, for sure. And it, it's such a big, it gives you a bigger range of hunting too, because you can throw it further and faster, I think faster too, right? Like it's a, like with it,
it's got a lot of speed action. Speed and distance.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. So. Plus the skill of a certain hunter too. I mean, it takes a lot of practice to be able to really use these things with any sort of accuracy.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah. So, all right. So we basically use all of these techniques, as you can see, you know, from the obsidian sourcing and networking to the types of materials to the types of tools and everything, and just pull all that together and start, you know, painting a little picture of this person or people that left these here.
We forgot to even mention it yet because we were talking about the tools, but there's actually a piece of folded up antelope hide in the cache, I guess you could call it, as well, which is so cool because it, I mean, a very versatile piece of hide, right? You could have done anything with it. You could make a bag, clothing. Maybe it was just for fixing, you know, things as they broke. But yeah, just another, like, I love that like tangible piece of like daily life, right? Like you've got this kit of hunting tools and you're like, oh yeah, throw in some antelope hide too, because you never know when you might need to replace something or fix something or whatever. So that's awesome.
Yeah. All right. Well, we're going to go from here down to Peru, where they were traveling through the gates of the gods and trying to find their alien ancestors.
Oh, God.
Back in a minute.
Can we have an episode without aliens?
No. Welcome back to the Archaeology Show, episode 303. And I got to preface this by saying, you know, I pulled this article in, and the only reason I did it was because just for you guys, because I feel like the Graham Hancock of it all. And we've covered Ancient Apocalypse.
Yep.
We've talked about his whole, you know, everything we have today and all their ancient societies. We owe it all to an ancient civilization that came before and started everything. And I just didn't want people reading this article, you know, haphazardly on their own and being like, look, here's proof.
Yeah.
Because it's not true.
Right.
And you know, this one, the link we even have for this one is from the Daily Freaking Mail, right? And I just wanted to show the absurdity of it.
I know. Like, not the best source of news, but that's okay. We can pick through and find the gems in there. Yeah.
No, this is what's out. This is what people are reading, right? This is what came right across my Apple News and even Google News and everywhere. And then I found a bunch of other sources talking about it. I'm actually not even sure why it's in the news right now.
I know. I was just going to say, I read this whole article. I don't see anything new about it. It's like somebody just got it into the news cycle and now it's just making the rounds for unknown reasons.
Well, and again, we've talked about this before. Sometimes that happens where some sort of news outlet will report something and other people just need content and they will just jump on it and they'll be like, as reported in the Daily Mail, blah, 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 blah. They don't even look to see if something current was done. They don't care.
Right.
They just need their own clicks.
Yep.
So, all right, let's talk about what this actually is and where it is and what's going on here. But we're in the Andes Mountains of Peru, so Rachel should know all about it. I'm sure she's been here.
I have not been here specifically because this is in the southern part of Peru. It's located near Lake Titicaca, I believe, which is on the border of Peru and Bolivia, I think.
I would not know.
I'm pretty sure. And it is not a part of Peru that I have been to. However, I have heard of this Gate of the Gods thing, and it is really, really cool. So definitely go look at the pictures and the link so you can get an idea about it.
Yeah. So the Gate of the Gods is, it's also Gate of the Gods at Aramu Muru.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. So All right. Located again near Lake Titicaca, it features a large door-like structure carved into natural rock face. Again, it's a door-like structure. It looks like a door carved into rock face. It's not actually a door.
No, it's just not
shaped,
a door.
It's shaped like a door.
Right.
23 feet by 23 feet. Roughly, that's roughly, it's not actually measured in feet, with a smaller alcove-like door within the larger one. Now, of course, these aren't actually doors because they don't go anywhere. They're just shapes carved into rock that in today's looks and meanings, they look like doors.
Right.
Okay. So people so have called them doors.
Immediately, you're applying a modern idea of what a gate or a door is to this ancient thing that is carved into.
Right. Now,
yeah.
Now, to be fair, it looks like a door.
It really does.
It looks like if you said the right words, you would go into the giant dwarf kingdom and have gold.
It does. Like,
yes. Like if you said the right
and enter, right?
Yes. If you said the right elven words, it would actually open. Like, that's what it looks like. Yeah. To be fair.
For sure. So it does look like that.
Like somebody was going for something and they stopped.
Yeah.
Yeah. Now, but what's really going on here? I mean, I don't know what's really going on here. Nobody does. But what people are saying is that it's like what it's been for, you know, as long as people know, because we don't know when it came from or where it came from. But it's always been to the locals this symbolic portal, right? Yeah. It's got a symbolic representation. It's been carved with precision in this reddish sandstone, and nobody knows the civilization that's responsible for it, and nobody knows why they did it.
Right.
It's just been done.
Yeah. So. And there are, you know, these local legends around it. The local indigenous communities have long told stories about the gate being a portal to other dimensions or the land of the gods. And they speak of heroes, deities, whoever, passing through this Puerta de Wayumarca, City of the Spirits.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's obviously it's something that who no matter who carved it, it has been adopted into the lore of whoever lives near it. Right. Of course it would be. It's such a unique, interesting thing on the landscape.
Yeah. And because nobody knows where it came from, everybody assumes it came before them. And if you go back far enough, it came before everybody. Mm-hmm. And since nobody knows where it came from, they're saying, you know, well, everybody says it was an advanced civilization because it had to be advanced if nobody knows where it came from. If it's a lost portal and if it's a mystical portal, it must be advanced and it predates the Inca. So there's of course a lost civilization hypothesis that it predates all these things because it is carved with some kind of precision. There's some pretty straight sides on it and things like that.
Yeah,
and if it came from a long time ago and it has right angles, it must be somebody who had advanced technology because nobody in the right mind could carve a right angle 5,000 years ago. Right. I mean, or however long ago. And when people go there, because it's been given this mystical, you know, sort of significance, people feel these energies when they go there.
Yeah, but it's like the same as at Stonehenge, right? Like people are always feeling energies at wherever they go when it's something that's unexplained. And okay, sure, we don't exactly know who made it, but we do know some things about it. We can get into that in a second. And we don't know the reason it was made or what they were doing with it. So that just leads humans to just speculate and apply like spiritual ideas to it.
Yeah.
I'm not even mad about that. Go ahead. Be spiritual about it.
Sure.
Feel things when you're there. Like that's great. But the problem comes when you start attributing it to some kind of lost culture or, God forbid, aliens, which I don't even like want to go down that road. Listen, aliens did not carve this door. Shut the door on that idea. No pun intended. Like, let's move on. That did not happen.
I mean, if we could find the key for this little keyhole thing here.
It does look like a keyhole, doesn't it? Like,
I know.
I get it. I get why.
Yeah.
I
mean, it's Stargate. That's what it is. Oh, you ever seen Stargate? It's Stargate. I'm not saying it's Stargate, but it's Stargate.
I cannot with that.
Yeah.
Anyway, so let's talk about what like the mainstream archaeological community says about it. Okay. So obviously it's different. It's unusual.
Yeah.
It is pre-Inca, which articles like this love to throw around phrases like pre-Inca, but like, let's not forget that the Incas were the last big civilization in South America. There were plenty before them. I personally worked on one of them that predated the Incas. So predating the Incas is not like that crazy of a statement to say. So
it's also pre-Columbian.
Yeah. anything indigenous to the Americas is pre-Columbian, but okay, go on.
It's also pre the Toyota Prius.
Yep, also that. Why the Toyota Prius?
I don't know.
How did that pop in your head?
Yeah, I don't know. It's pre a lot of things.
Okay, it is pre a lot of things. Yeah, so one of the guesses around it is that it was created by the people who inhabited this region before the Incan Empire did, which would be the Tiwanaku culture. And they are known for their impressive stonework around Lake Titicaca. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, that's sort of the assumption, but it sounds like there's not any artifacts or anything that can be dated associated with this stone portal or whatever you want to call it.
I mean, if you want my guess, I'm guessing one of two things happened. Either A, somebody started to carve this by someone else's direction, probably some sort of leader or something like that. And they said, I want you to make something. And I love this stone formation over here. It's great rock.
It's easy make for carving.
It. Yeah.
Yeah.
Make it and make it out of one big piece of rock. And they said, oh, okay. And either A, the leader died.
Right.
Or was overthrown. And then they just, well, I don't have to do this anymore.
Yeah.
Or B, somebody was deciding to make something and the somebody died.
Yeah.
Right. And nobody knew how to do it. Mm-hmm. Right. Like the person who was doing this died. I mean, it's just like, you know, but this also does kind of look finished too.
It does.
You know, this is finished in its own right. It doesn't have to be leading into something else because it does have a square shape. There is a thing in the middle of it. You know, maybe this is the finished product. Maybe it was somebody's artistic expression of something.
Yeah. And like, let's not forget about all the things that are potentially missing from this. There could have been organic structures of some sort that were built up around this. Now, when you have like a wooden structure, you normally get like post holes or something showing that they were there. But because it was into this rock,
it's all rock,
they might be gone by now. But there could have been something. This could have been the back of a structure that had some kind of wooden structure around it. You know, so all I'm trying to say is that this is not necessarily the only thing that they were doing whatever they were doing with. So
Other possible functions too. It could have been ceremonial, of course
ritual.
it could have been a symbolic boundary marker for some sort of territory. I mean, they could have just, because it's really big, they don't really have it placed on the landscape, but if you can see this from a long ways away, something of this magnitude would really have an impact on people in the area. And they were like, oh, Christ, we're near that thing again.
Yeah.
I guess we better go the other way.
The thing is that if you look at, there's one zoomed out picture that doesn't show the door itself, but it's like the surrounding geology. And it looks like the spines of a dinosaur, right? Like, it's so distinctive. So sure, maybe I would see like marking territory as a possibility, but they also kind of wouldn't need to because it's such a unique like landscape, but anyway.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yep. Could be, some would suggest astronomical alignment cause they always do, but but that doesn't necessarily make any sense to me because they didn't move any stones into place.
Right.
This has been carved into natural rock.
Yep.
And that natural rock already is aligned with something.
Yep.
So
they're just using what's there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It also looks to me when you look at the more zoomed out version that they started carving something into the left of it that was unfinished.
Yeah, it does kind of look that way. Yeah.
It really is an unfinished project.
Yeah.
You know, there's another almost doorway there or something.
It very much feels unfinished, number one.
Yeah.
And, you know, maybe it was a doorway to the gods. Maybe it very well.
Going for.
Yeah. Like maybe that is symbolically what they were trying to create with it. We don't know. We don't know what their religious ideas were, but it's entirely possible.
Yeah. I mean,
sure, it certainly looks like a doorway.
There's literally no way we can get into the minds of the ancient people.
Right.
We can just speculate, but I think it's important to know from an article like this is that we shouldn't speculate into the wacky.
Right.
And I hesitate to say the word crazy cause that's not really a good word, but we shouldn't speculate into the just the fantastical. Right?
Yeah.
Stay in the realm of possibility.
Stay in the real world, because there were real people who, yeah, in this area, who occupied this area at this time, although we don't really know time, but we know it was right before the Incans. And they did this. Why they did it, we don't know. And it's fun to speculate. Like, yeah, go on, speculate away. That's really fun. But like, we don't need to bring the A word into it. It's just right, really not necessary.
Archaeology.
Oh, crap.
Oh.
There's so many A words. You know the A word I'm talking about, though. Yeah. Everybody knows.
All right. Astronomy. All
right. Oh, jeez. There's really not too many A words. I can think of another one.
Apocalypse. Ancient.
Too many.
Advil. Wait.
Okay. Okay. Yeah.
All right. So, with that, we are going to go all the way over to Ukraine, mm-hmm, and we're going to talk about some ancient ivory. Back in a minute. Welcome back to episode 303. And this time, as I said, we are in the Ukraine, mm-hmm, and we're talking about ivory.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mammoth ivory.
Mm-hmm.
I don't mean just big ivory. I mean actual mammoth ivory.
Like from an actual mammoth.
From an actual mammoth.
Yeah.
Yes. And I don't mean today. Yeah.
Nope. Not those ones that they claim they right are creating today. No, not those.
Right.
No. So this is really cool. Archaeologists have unearthed a collection of artifacts made from mammoth ivory, and those artifacts date back to the Paleolithic period. And it was really interesting because they actually thought it was just faunal remains, probably mm-hmm bones, I'm guessing. But once they got it back to the lab and they started doing this ESR electronic spin resonance on them, that's when they figured out that it was actually ivory. And then they, you know, from there, they're able to figure out that it's mammoth. So,
yeah.
Yeah, that's really cool.
Yeah. So what kind of objects are we talking about here? So the tools and ornaments that we're talking about, that's what we're talking about here, mm-hmm, include awls or needles, mm-hmm, and decorative items,
yeah,
which is pretty cool. And yeah, these are like beads, pendants, and the level of details in the carvings is kind of amazing. Take a look at the pictures in the article that we linked. And I know the article is mensjournal.com, but listen.
Yes, it is.
Again, you're going to find these articles all over the place. It's not yeah always going to be a journal article. And that's why I just posted this.
Yeah.
And like, this came across my news. You're going to read this. So yep, why don't we just take a look and see what they found?
Yeah, so, definitely.
Yeah.
And do you know what awls are? Are you familiar?
Yeah. It's like,
they're like punching holes yeah, through yeah, leather.
Exactly.
Yeah. 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 Okay, just making sure, because that is really cool that these are tools that are used for, you know, sewing together pieces of hide or whatever mm-hmm kind of fabric they would have had. Now, these are super old, so I don't think they would have had fabric like we're thinking of. It would have definitely been hides or things like that.
I mean, listen, anybody living in Ukraine had to stay warm.
Well, they did have, yeah, they had to do what they had to do, right?
Yeah, so yeah, they're going to do whatever they can do, yeah. And they had mammoth skin to work with, mm-hmm, so anyway, it's the age really of the artifacts that is significant here, because these are dating back an incredibly long period of time. Yeah.
Yeah. So these artifacts date to around 400,000 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And that predates previous discoveries of ivory tools by nearly 300,000 years.
Yeah.
So that is pushing back the timeline on these like pretty significantly.
Yeah.
You know, they have some Neanderthal ivory tools that date back to around 120,000 years ago. But this is quite a bit further than that. So,
yeah. 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 We're going back quite a ways on this.
Yeah.
But again, I mean, we knew some form of, I don't know, ancestor, not necessarily Homo sapien, obviously going back that far, but some form of ancestor was living in this area. Just because we didn't have evidence for it, we knew they had to be like surrounding themselves with something.
Right.
Whether or not they were sewing these things together was probably evidence we didn't have.
Right.
But just because we didn't have it didn't mean it didn't exist. And now that we have that evidence, though, is pretty cool.
Yeah.
I think.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. I mean, it really is interesting, though, to know who the first people were that just said, hey, we need to cinch this stuff up. Because I'm willing to bet that the people that moved north, as they just were like following game or doing whatever they were doing, you know, they're like, it's kind of starting to get pretty cold here.
Right.
Like, what are we going to do about this?
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, they're coming out of Africa. They're, you know, doing whatever they're doing. It's just like, where's that in your brain? You know what I mean? Like, you're not wearing anything, or maybe you've covered yourself with some things and maybe you don't have any sewing skills, but you're trying to figure this out. And these skins, these hides, they're drying in the sun. They're just throwing them to the side because they're just trying to get to the meat from these big animals and even the smaller animals. Well, at some point, somebody's going to pick one of those up and be like, this is quite warm.
Yeah.
And, you know, let's trim this up and make it fit better.
Right.
Totally. You know? Yeah. Another indication that we get from the people living in this area by using ivory at this time was that they were showing great resourcefulness, according to this article, and just looking at this, because they were using all parts of the animal. We know they were eating, of course, whatever they could. But as I mentioned, the hides, and now we have the ivory. It's just, you know, using whatever they can. And they were probably using, I would imagine, the bones for certain things as well. I'm kind of a little surprised that they didn't find bone pieces as part of this assemblage as well.
Mm-hmm. Well, they might have.
They may have. It's just not, yeah. It's just not important enough for this article in particular, I guess.
Yeah. One of the things they speculated on here in the article is that it's possible that they, because, you know, ivory is fairly soft compared to stone. But it's possible that they just didn't have access to stones that were better. And so they sort of used whatever material was available to them, which in this case was ivory. So, yeah. And for comparison, the Mohs scale is what is used for measuring hardness. Yeah. And ivory is like between 2 and 4 generally. And like flint or quartz or another material like that is like 8 or 9. So it's like significantly harder.
Yeah. Yeah, it shows a lot of care and artistry, really, to carve these objects and to use them.
Yeah, for sure. Now, in this one article I'm looking at here, I'll add this link into it. I just was looking for, I wanted to see like a little dissension, right? Like, is there anybody who doesn't agree with this or feels like it's too much of a leap? Like, I'm getting like a little bit of Cerruti vibes here. Just a little bit.
Really?
Like, one researcher thinks that, yes, these are 100% tools, and it's pushing back the timeline by 300,000 years. Like, let's march forward. And like, that's that, done deal. But there are others that are suggesting that, first of all, there could be misdating happening.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know what their methods were. This article doesn't really go into like the super scientific specifics of it. But, you know, misdating is always a possibility. But the big one, and this is why I'm getting Cerruti vibes, but the big possibility that makes this not accurate is the potential for natural modification.
Oh, yeah.
You know, like the way things get knocked around naturally, especially by water or wind activity, it can make it look a lot like a tool. And that is part of the problem with the tools that are at the Cerruti site in San Diego. We've talked about that a whole bunch of times. We don't need to rehash that now. And that is something to consider with this site, too, is that it's possible that that's what's going on here. The main authors push back and say that the natural origins aren't likely because they found a whole bunch of stuff, basically. Yeah. The volume is what makes it not likely to be natural. So anyway, I think it's still a really cool thing to look at.
All right. Well, I guess we'll have to wait and see then if they have any more discussion on this or if any more articles come out about this.
Yeah, because like just because it's in a peer-reviewed article doesn't mean that it's, you know, gospel, right? Like,
yeah, for sure.
There can be people that come out for and against it. So I'll be interested to see how the conversation continues with this.
Right.
Only, and I'm only being skeptical because of this 300,000 year, you know, jump back in time. That is just such a big jump. I mean, you're talking about like a hominid species that is completely different 300,000 years earlier. So, but doing the same things, it's interesting. So,
yeah. I mean, like I said, though, if you're living up in that area, it would be shocking if you weren't doing something, you know what I mean? And this isn't, I just find that this isn't a huge leap technologically, I guess. It's just, have we not found this stuff?
Oh, sure.
You know?
Yeah.
Yeah. But then if you've looked at, I mean, if you've got a sample set of, you know, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of Neanderthal sites in the area, and nobody's ever found anything like this.
Yeah, that all date, you know, to this time period.
Yeah, how many date to this time period?
Yeah.
And nothing's ever been found?
Right,
that's also a pretty good indication that what's going on here.
Yeah.
You know?
Mm-hmm.
So.
Yeah, I don't know. Knows? I mean, it's super cool no matter what.
Yeah.
Whether the dating is wrong or it's right. Mm-hmm. You know, having ivory like this, it does really seem like there's human activity, humanoid activity, whatever the human species was,
yeah,
you know, so there definitely is something going on here. It's, it's a cool story. Definitely want to keep following it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Well, with that, we will finish this one up next week. Tune in, because we're going to talk about our experiences in Bath, England, mm-hmm. and touring the so-called Roman baths.
So-called. Well, they're the Roman baths.
Not according to some of the one-star reviews.
Oh, no. One-star reviews again.
All right. See you next week.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to The Archaeology Show. Feel free to comment and view the show notes on the website at www.arcpodnet.com. Find us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at ArcPodNet. Music for this show is called I Wish You Would Look from the band Sea Hero. Again, thanks for listening and have an awesome day. The Archaeology Podcast Network is 10 years old this year. Our executive producer is Ashley Airy. Our social media coordinator is Matilda Siebrecht. And our chief editor is Rachel Roden. The Archaeology Podcast Network was co-founded by Chris Webster and Tristan Boyle in 2014 and is part of Cultura Media and DigTech LLC.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.